Hey, so why are some leaders successful at engaging and motivating their teams? Some are not. In a word, I think it's connection. So today I'm going to talk with Michael J. Gelb, author of The Art of Connection, about how you can get more connected to your team so you and your team can experience even better results. Now, full disclosure, 20 years ago, I got to meet Michael when I worked at Strong Investments, when he wrote his book, Thinking Like Leonardo da Vinci. And I've been following him around since. I've read his book about wine. I've read stuff about genius. And now The Art of Connection is right in my wheelhouse. And I am expecting this is going to be just as much fun as it was 20 years ago when we had dinner together. How you doing, Michael?
Fabulous. It's even more fun. We get more skilled at having fun as the years go by.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And maybe a little bit more intelligent about the wine we drink as well. I didn't know that you wrote a book about wine. So, Michael, how do you move from wine to Da Vinci to connection and then eventually to a book about, you know, about the economy and other stuff like that? How does that happen?
Well, I connect with the things that I'm most passionate about, that I'm most curious about and interested in, that I believe will help other people. So I look for the sweet spot in everything I do between what I'm most passionate about, really want to learn about, what I think can help others and make a contribution to the world. And then I bring those together. And obviously there's a range of interests, as you mentioned. The wine book came out of the same impulse that led to The Art of Connection, because what I realized many years ago in teaching people how to think like Leonardo da Vinci, how to innovate like Edison, modeling the skills of the greatest geniuses who ever lived and applying them in our everyday lives, that's really fun and it's fascinating. But if you want to really apply it, it's all about relationships. It's all about connections. So it's actually relatively easy to get genius level ideas. The tricky part is making them happen, because that requires collaboration. It requires relationships. It requires connection. So the wine came out of my observation that clients would always ask me for team building. They said, we're learning a lot. It's really fun. It's really interesting. It's inspiring. But we have some issues on our team. We have people who just don't know each other that well. They're a little uptight. They just merged, or somebody took somebody else over or spun off. And this is only accelerated in the years I've been in business. It's faster, you have to know people quicker. So they'd always ask me, can you do some team building with us? And a lot of all my seminars, I teach people juggling, we do martial arts, we do lots of fun things that help bring a team together. But I thought, how about some wine tasting? And everybody loved that idea.
Of course, who doesn't love wine?
Right? But what's great is you get people to do a comparative wine tasting, and you bring their attention to the wines. It helps to use finer wines, so people realize they're in the presence of a work of art and a phenomenon. Usually people are a little uptight and they don't want to get the wrong answer, but we finesse them past those inhibitions. Plus then the wine takes over and it inspires them to be more convivial and more open. And it's just, it always amazed me how you could take these stiff people who didn't know each other and were kind of formal, and you guide them through this appreciation of wine over the course of the evening, and they walk out of there with their arms around each other laughing, and they're just connected. So the wine and the art of connection are all part of my my grand strategy to help people collaborate and enjoy themselves and actually get way more work done with much less effort.
I love that. I love that. And I definitely have seen that to be true. I mean, those team building events where we've had a couple of cocktails or at least found a way to break the ice, whatever that is, right? We went golfing last week with my team, and certainly that helps. So I think that definitely leads to connection, but that also leads me to, like, you call it the art of connection, not the science, which I think is really interesting. Why do you call it the art of connection?
Yes. Oh, thank you. That's a fabulous question, because the book is packed with science. There's lots,
exactly,
of research. There's lots of research on what works and what doesn't work to connect with other people. How do you shift out of stress hormones in a group? You know, how do you get out of cortisol and adrenaline and the other stress hormones? And how do you shift into dopamine and oxytocin and serotonin and endorphins? Because that's scientifically, that's what we're really talking about. But you can read all the research and you still won't be able to do it.
That's right. Yeah, that's the best part.
Right. So it helps to understand the science and to know what's going on, but to apply it really is an art. And it means paying attention. It means noticing what works and what doesn't work. It means learning and being curious and discovering that what worked in one person or one group can't be mechanically applied into another situation or another group. You have to actually be present and attuned, like an artist is in creating a dance or a painting or a work of musical composition. There are certain rules and laws of the universe that will make for a more effective composition, a more effective work of music, a more effective choreography. So we want to understand what those are, and that's the science, but applying them is the art.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really important, because I get asked all the time, like, how do you do what you do? And honestly, I don't think about it. I'm just fully present with what I get to do. And I really think that's the difference. Instead of doing, we have to be-ing, right? We have to be in the moment. We have to be with the other person. And that's why I never script my interviews. I don't think about that. I'm just present with what the other person says. I take it in, I process, and then I share something back, asking a question, paraphrasing, going at your pace versus my preferred pace. And it's just interesting how few people, though, have that art, because they want to check the box and say, no, hold on, I did these three things, Phil. I mean, Michael, you've got 7 relationship building skills, so I got the skills down, man. It's not working. What's going on?
Right. Read it again, right?
Right. Well, that's the thing, right? I mean, because the funny thing is, of course, right, in prep, not only did I read the book, but then I go and get the – I went and went and got the summary of the book. And, of course – they lead with the takeaways. So we could go through the 7 steps and we could give away the farm, right, with the 7 steps, and you still don't get the essence of the book. And I think that's what makes the book so genius to me.
Thank you. Well, it's similar. What I aim to do in all of my books is take timeless wisdom and make it timely. Take universal truths and make them immediately relevant and applicable. So people have said to me, well, I don't know, you know, I feel like there's years and years of material in here. And I say, yeah, how about the rest of your life? And you'll still be learning, because you're not going to master the art of connection. You're not going to master thinking like Leonardo da Vinci. What you can do is engage in the process so that it transforms your life. And then, as we discuss in the book, emotions are contagious, for better or for worse. So be careful. And we want people to catch and spread the inspiration of these universal truths and be inspired by these stories of others who have shifted or changed or awakened to some humbling insight about themselves. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about leadership. If you're not humble, you're not paying attention.
Absolutely. Well, because you're failing. I mean, you're, and by failing, I don't mean fatal failure, but I mean, you're learning, right? You're failing. You're thinking, boy, that didn't work. So I got to try something else. Or, wow, that was really great. Let's see if I turn that up a little bit on this person, perhaps it's going to work better. But that's the humility and the hubris to understand that we have to slow down and to be with the person that we're trying to lead and not just try to engage the mass. Is that right?
That is right. And part of why it's such a pleasure to speak with you is, as you articulated earlier, you are present and open and spontaneous and curious. So we can really engage. I mean, it's easy to forget, oh, we're on Facebook Live and
right.
Meeting all these people because that quality of presence is where everything begins. And once you've got that, then you can actually apply all the other elements in the book. So this is so important that I gave it a Latin name. There's a Latin motto that starts the book, and it is congiungere ad salvendum. Congiungere ad salvendum, which means connect before solving.
Ooh, I like that.
Connect before solving. So really cool. Earlier, well, I guess it was last week. Last week, I was in Madison, Wisconsin. And I was with the people who are the senior corporate coaches of the senior people of the corporation that I was doing a seminar for. And we were just getting together in order to learn from one another and enjoy each other's company. And the gentleman who I was lucky enough to get some time with, I was actually able to visit him in his place, 90 years old. And he worked directly with Carl Rogers. And he was one of the mentors, this gentleman was one of the mentors of Marshall Rosenberg, who entered NVC, nonviolent communication. And Carl Rogers was always one of my heroes, still is, because what Carl Rogers, for people who don't know, is that one of the pioneers of human potential psychology and one of the greatest therapists ever. And what he figured out, his genius insight, was that if you're fully present with people in a unconditionally caring way, that miraculously, people seem to improve.
That seems pretty simple, though.
And if you're not, they don't, almost no matter what therapeutic modality you apply. And the same thing applies to leadership, it applies to management, it applies to parenting, it applies to creative thinking. So the first thing to do is to be. And to be with people. Now, you're not just being together in business. We're not just all going to go in the hot tub or hold hands or meditate. And we don't have to do anything external that is some demonstration of affection or connection. So it's not about external manifestations of being a nice person or anything like that. It's just being fully right there with who you're with in a way that is caring and connected about that person as a human being and not just as a means to your business end. Because people sense that. And if they sense that you respect them, that you care about them, that you see them as a being with a soul, then they're inspired. Then they want to engage. Then they want to bring their best. Moreover, and here's something that a lot of people miss, especially in a very action results oriented types. Who are, let's face it, a lot of those people are very successful and they are hiring us. but they want to be more successful and they want us to help them get to the next level. And here's the thing that a lot of those people are missing that they love, and it changes their lives. It's not just that other people will respond to you more effectively if you are present in this way. When you are present in this way, by being present in your own being, which you have to be with others, you humanize yourself. You nurture your own engagement. You create more of a sense of depth of being, and therefore are more susceptible to joy, to grace, to creative inspiration yourself. So you let go of this sense of materiality and mechanism and separateness, and you shift into this more intrinsic, soul-oriented way of being. Not in any woo-woo way, but just in a simple, it's effortless. It's actually effortless because you're just letting go of something that's quite an effort. And then from there, solutions emerge more naturally, more fluidly. Ideas flow more effectively. Fun happens more spontaneously. And so once you know that, why would you do anything else?
Wow. So that leads me to a great question though, Michael. Now that we know the answer, why do we do everything else? I mean, why don't we just focus on being, right? Because that sounds so simple to me. And yet I will tell you that maybe in the last 5, maybe 7 years, I've finally learned that and let go of much of the rest of it. But it's hard as heck, man. It's like, I mean, it seems so obvious once you say it, and yet it seems so difficult. And I fought it. I had friends that I would fight with, right? That, no, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? And that's not the answer. It's, what do I be? Who am I?
Yes. Well, what's interesting, though, I thank you so much for sharing that, because it's not actually hard to let go. Letting go is the easiest thing in the world. Being, you already are being. You can't help it. You just don't notice it because there's so much noise and habitual conditioning and shoulds. People have been shoulding on you since you were a little kid. Society shoulds on you. Your boss is shoulding on you. So you internalize that and you're shoulding on yourself. And it doesn't mean that we don't have obligations and things that we really should do. We should. So it's not just some hippie, dippy, trippy thing. It's just wisdom is connected, and deeper wisdom is connected and springs from presence, which is also the only time your life is ever happening is now. It's just the only time it's ever happened. There is no someday. It's a notion you call a memory that you either experience now or not. So now is the only time that there is, and here is the only place that there is, and being is what you want to have be experiencing in the here and now. And if you could just start with, you know, Ram Dass, a.k.a. Richard Alpert, wrote a book called Be Here Now. That's really the main thing we all need to know. And we all know it, but we forget it because we think we have to be something different than we are and do something different, and that someday things will be different and then we'll be happy. And when I have this, then I'll really be able to be present, and if only that hadn't happened in the past, then I'd be much happier right now. And I don't say this, I say this with full compassion and empathy, because I fall into this as much as anybody. But I coach myself to wake up in the midst of all that, notice it. This is where a sense of humor really helps. And just notice that which is aware of all the yada blah, 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 stories, dialogue is always changing. The voices, the feelings, the thoughts, the physical state, always shifting, changing, yada, yada, yada. But that which is aware and present is always aware and present, and it's always the same, and it's always here, and it's always now. So the more we just wake up to what is already here and now, the more spaciousness one naturally experiences. It's easy. You do find, one will find a sense of, oh, well, thank you. Yes, it's a little easier to breathe. Oh, I notice I can feel what I feel a little bit more. And then I'm more present and ready and able to then do what needs to be done, because we still have to do stuff, but we want to do it from a place of presence and being rather than obsession and compulsion and neurosis and anxiety.
Well, and rather than a sense of obligation as well. I think what happens is we get much more committed when we're being. We get more committed because we feel it more and it hits our heart instead of just our brain. And the, you know, to your point, right, about the science, the dopamine changes. The biology of our chemistry changes because now we're being and things slow down to speed up. And we hit that flow state that we're so desperately seeking because we're not so focused on doing.
Well said. Yes.
So, wow. Well, let's talk a little bit about these seven skills though, because I think folks, you know, they hear all that and they're like, okay, great. Now, what do I need to do? I hate to say that, but I'm sure that's true. Some people are listening and thinking, boy, how do I do this? So one of the things that you talk about though is kind of funny. It's be a glowworm. So what the heck does that mean, Michael? And how does that help people?
Yes. So that comes from a quote from one of my favorite role models for leadership of all time, Winston Churchill. And Winston Churchill said, "We are all worms, but I do believe that I am a glowworm." And you have to picture, I don't know if you've ever been to Churchill's war rooms in London, but I actually led a team building exercise for a corporate client in the British command headquarters, Churchill's war rooms, which are in a bunker underneath the city of London. And here's a little cot where Churchill slept. And there's the map on the wall of Europe with the pins in it, which represented troop movements.
Wow.
And over here is where he did the broadcasts. So you have to picture this. It's hard for us to imagine 56 nights in a row of being bombed all night. And not just a little bomb here and there, but massive explosions everywhere, so that people had to evacuate to below the ground. They were living in the subway, unless you were in a bunker like Churchill. A lot of people were evacuated to the countryside. But imagine that's 56 nights in a row of bombing that starts as soon as it gets dark and goes all night long. And see, back then, the British didn't know that they were going to win the war. They were facing what seemed to be an unstoppable force of evil, and it was extremely dire situation. But Winston Churchill inspired a whole country to carry on in the face of seemingly hopeless odds. And he did it. You know what's so cool about the time we live in now? You can actually go on YouTube and you can hear the original Churchill speeches. You can hear him say, "We will fight them." I mean, it's never give up, never give up, never, ever give up. And his tone of voice, it is as serious and big. It's not a cheery, "Come on, we can do it." Doesn't sound optimistic. It just sounds courageous. It sounds realistic. It sounds soulful at a level that you can still hear in the recording that's free to us all now. So here's, this inspired a whole nation to rally, to clean up the rubble every night, to dig people out, to bury the bodies, to keep on fighting, and eventually to prevail. So emotions are contagious. That's what being a glowworm means. Emotions are contagious, for better or for worse. Be careful what you catch and spread. And one of the main points, people then say the objection, well, I'm not Churchill. I'm not the prime minister. I'm not the CEO. I'm just a junior person, or I'm a young person starting out. But here's the thing we're learning. Everybody matters. Everybody matters. And you have way more influence than you may be aware. And if you learn to make that influence intentional, if you intentionally focus on uplifting through your presence, even by the, just by the small acts of kindness. So, and there's a lot of research we cited in the book. Here's some of the science is Jane Dutton, Monica Warline have shown that it's these little acts of kindness every day. Just, you know, getting coffee for your colleague, asking somebody how their child is feeling after they you know, fell down, hurt themselves, or how their Little League game went, or how somebody's vacation went. But asking in a real way and just showing that you care in little ways. These little actions create ripples of positivity and connection and make for a wonderful corporate culture versus the opposite. So your choice in that moment to lead with an uplifting energy versus your reactive, tired, whiny, commiserative energy makes a big difference. Makes a difference to your family, makes a difference to your partner, to your friends, to your church, to your synagogue, to your mosque, to your community group, and certainly to your workplace, and even to just so-called strangers that you meet when you walk down the street or check out from the grocery store or do whatever you do.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. To move from Churchill to the present with that and think about the little things we can do, whether no matter where we are, I think is super, super powerful. And that takes me to another point that I think is super important, and that's your fifth one about balancing the energy exchange. Because being a glowworm and balancing that energy exchange, I think, are really, really important. Of the 7 points that you make in the book, Michael, those are, to me, those are the two biggest ones. And so talk to us about the balancing of the energy exchange, because I think so many people get this one wrong.
Yes, and this can be a life-changing insight for people. So heaven is when we have a fluid, generous exchange of energy, when we feel grateful to one another. This is how we want our relationships to be. I'm blessed. That's how my relationship is with my wife. And she'll say that's how her relationship is with me. Because, you know, that's what I always tell people. If anybody ever writes a book on human potential or self-help or how to just ask their wife or their husband or their boyfriend or their girlfriend or their partner, ask them if they really live what they're writing about. Because that person will know whether it's complete fantasy and delusion. But you can ask my wife. I'd bring her over now if she was here. and what's there's a story in the book actually about our first date. And we kind of knew from the beginning that this was really significant. And we had a conversation on our very first date about, well, she actually raised the fact, because I still am much older than her. And at the time, my career was much more advanced and I had more financial wherewithal. And she had just come out of a relationship with someone who was older than her, but not as old as I was, and more successful than her, but not as successful as I was. Because at the time I met her, she was an apprentice at one of the great operatic programs in the country. So she was, you know, still earning her stripes in her career, and I was already a best-selling author and so on and so forth. So she said to me on our date, she said, you know, I've just come out of this relationship, my last relationship, I felt manipulated by this person who had more power in the world than I did and more money. And, you know, you're more powerful and even wealthier. How's this going to work out? And I was really present with her question, and I empathized with it because I know how important it is. And I was blessed that over the years when I was single, I've been in situations where I dated a couple of women who were much more financially successful than I was, super wealthy Wall Street people. And it's a really interesting dynamic if you're on the other side of that. So I really empathized, and I said to her, well, you know, the balance of energy in any relationship is really important. And it requires monitoring and an open dialogue, even, you know, whether you have the same amount of money, the same age, or the same power in the world, or different levels. You have to be open about it, be willing to be open about it and monitor it and always adjust it so that each person feels that the energy is flowing and they feel a sense of gratitude. And all I can say is I'm committed to that dialogue, and it's as important to me as it is to you. And I know that was the right answer because she jumped across the table and started kissing me, and we've been together ever since.
How long has it been, Michael?
It's almost 15 years.
Congratulations.
Thank you. But the same principle applies in all relationships. So Adam Grant's book, Give and Take, he talks about three kinds of people: givers, takers, and matchers. So givers are about 8% of the population, and they just give, give, give. Takers are about 8% of the population. They just take, take, take. Most of the rest of us are matchers, where we're looking to see where's the balance, because there's a natural wiring in the human psyche, in the human brain, for reciprocity. It's part of how we create our civilizations and societies, is through a balanced exchange of energy, goods, services. This is what makes capitalism work when it works. Now, what's fascinating is in the metrics of how people do in life, as you might imagine, matchers are most people, and it's their average. Takers often do well for a while, but then come crashing down. Givers tend to be at both the top and the bottom of the success metrics, because when givers are surrounded by takers, they have nervous breakdowns, they become enablers, their life force is drained, and they have a very rough time. But when givers are surrounded by other givers and matchers who support them and see how giving they are, and they get the right support team around them, then they really thrive. So, very important, if you're a giver, when it comes time to give, ask yourself these questions. Am I giving to a giver? Green light, it's gonna be fine. Am I giving to a matcher? Green light, it's gonna be fine. Am I giving to a taker? Caution, caution, caution. Learn to monitor, learn the skills of a matcher so that you can be sure that you're not getting your energy. And the thing about takers is they don't read books like this, and they don't listen to conversations like this usually. So we don't even, they need years of therapy and prayer and healing and help.
Awesome. Awesome. So takers are not listening. So find people that listen to this program and find to give to them. So that's good advice, Michael. I appreciate that. So,
I mean, we may have a few takers, and here's what I want them to take away. Because what's interesting is some people have become takers just because they just didn't know any better, and they feel the sense of scarcity. But as they calm down a little bit, maybe they've achieved some success, they start to look and say, what's the meaning of my life? What's the purpose? Okay, I've got enough from me. There's an awakening of conscience that takes place for many people who have been takers. And they begin to think, how can I give more? And it's good that, and what you'll get in the book are some skills for just how to do that. The people I'm talking about who don't listen are just all out narcissistic personality disorder. That's just 1% of psychopathic, sociopathic narcissists. That 1%, yeah, they don't read these kind of books.
Fantastic. Well, then we'll just ignore them and we'll get started in our own way on the art of connection. So speaking about that, Michael, as we wrap up here, we talked about being present, being available, being interested, and being really caring about the other person, being step one. What's the next step that people can take so that they can put this into practice for themselves and make this part of their leadership and sales and relationship journey?
Sure. Well, the next step, if we go in terms of the art of the book, is embracing the sense of humility and curiosity, which are also the secrets of becoming, everybody thinks they're a good listener, just like everybody thinks they're above average driver. But if you get out here on these roads, you'll know that's not true. And if you attend most meetings, you'll know that's not true. So the humility is the beginning of being a good listener. Instead of assuming that you understand, be curious, be open, assume that there's more to know. That attitude will strengthen your sense of presence, and the sense of presence naturally gives rise to that sense of humility and curiosity.
Excellent.
We go into that in the Art of Connection. I go into that in a lot more depth, and there's practices for how to actually improve your listening. And then the final skill in the book is, I call it turning friction into momentum, and it's about how to the reason it's the final skill is you have no hope of doing it if you haven't learned the other skills.
Wow. So the final skill, just recap for those that are listening, right, is about turning friction into momentum, taking conflict, which is an essential part of your relationships, and moving that into something better that you can actually use as fuel to fuel your connections.
Yes. So it's one of the big secrets of creative collaboration is learning how to have conflict that is respectful and dynamic and inspires thought. It's actually a secret of healthy relationships. It's being able to have a conflict, to disagree. But see, one of the points in this chapter that's so important is to separate the idea of conflict from a contest. We tend to think in terms of win and lose, which is good. I watched, my neighbor is a huge Green Bay Packers fan.
Hey, me too. Yay.
And I love Aaron Rodgers, but I mostly root for teams based on empathy. I don't really have a tribal affiliation, so I root for the people who I know will be happiest when their team wins. So I happened to notice that the Packers won, and I watched a little bit of the game. And it's fun. What makes a game great is you keep score. There's a winner and a loser on the field. But if you apply that same model to your relationships or to your conflicts with your children or your spouse or your team at work, it makes it worse. The goal of a football game is to score more points than the other team. The goal of a conflict in relationship is not to score more points than your boss or your colleague or your wife or your children. It's to use your creativity to figure out what are the underlying needs of the stakeholders and come up with new solutions to meet those needs. That's the goal of a conflict. It's understanding and meeting human needs, figuring out new ways to do that that we haven't thought of yet. And then you can feel how that inspires respect, and it inspires creativity instead of violence and the desire to dominate and you win and they lose. How can you win and your kids lose? If you win and your marketing department loses, you know, if you're a production and marketing loses, your company loses. So you all have to we're all in this together. And you know, more enlightened people realize that that's true for all of society, because we're all connected, whether we like it or not.
Yeah, absolutely. We are, for sure. So The Art of Connection is the book, folks. If you haven't picked up a copy by Michael J. Gelb, you absolutely need to. It's a fantastic book. Michael's at michaelgelb.com. It's G-E-L-B for those of you spelling at home. But Michael, if people want to talk to you a little bit more, if they have some questions, is there a favorite social media outlet you have where they can actually get to you and have some chats?
Sure. Well, the absolute best thing people can do is, as you suggested, go to michaelgelb.com, G-E-L-B, and sign up for our free newsletter. That's the number one thing to do. And then, yeah, I'd say find me on all the usual platforms. LinkedIn is my most active place, so I'm delighted to connect with more folks on LinkedIn. And I don't check, I have to confess, I don't do as much on Twitter and much on Facebook. I mean, I monitor them from time to time, and I have people who do that, but I do engage more on LinkedIn, and I love to hear from people who connect with me through michaelgelb.com.
Awesome. So folks, if you want to get more connected with Michael, go to michaelgelb.com. That's michaelgelb.com. Feel free to ask him some questions there. Connect with him on LinkedIn. Let him know you saw him on Conversation with Phil. Michael, it is a pleasure. I promise it will not be 20 years again before we have a conversation. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Phil.
Good times. Cheers.